Hi, welcome to End of Life Care Podcast and Why It Matters by Cam Early and James Langmaid.
To begin with a quote from Francis Mirna Cam, end of life care deals with people much closer to the death, often identified in studies by a physician saying she would not be surprised if the person died within the next year. While some refer to care in this period as helping people to die well, it is now common to speak of helping them to live an acceptable life until death. Our topic surrounds the care leading up to death from a perspective that most end-of-life care representatives, physicians, clergy, and family stand behind, in giving the person a respectful, dignified, and painless send-off. Physicians take the Hippocratic Oath, an ancient Greek tradition in which physicians must uphold ethical standards in medicine to properly treat their patients, sworn upon by the Greek gods of healing. Fast forward to modern day, physicians still take this oath. However, it is for the good of the state, not overwatched by the Greek deities. End-of-life care is an integral part of this process, making sure that those leaving this world have a comfortable transition. Additionally, having physicians, family, and clergy follow the cognizant wishes of the nearly deceased is an important key to helping to ensure a proper send-off. Following the cognizant wishes of the patient in the end-of-life care process, whether cultural, spiritual, or euthanasia, in order to help ensure dignity and comfortability in the final days of the patient is of the utmost importance.
All right, to get into our first question, would a cultural or spiritual education requirement be a good addition to nursing or medical schools in order to provide a better experience for each patient in the end-of-life care process? We have a quote here from Tyler Mazanak. It's also important to understand that how patients identify themselves affect their health and healthcare up to the end of their lives. Clinicians, therefore, can't expect to provide good healthcare without in-depth knowledge of the practices and beliefs of people from many cultures. I think it's important to understand where people come from and understand their backgrounds to be able to give them the most beneficial care that they can provide from a physician's standpoint, and understanding any differences in their culture would be able to help and support their beliefs. And I think that you get into this in a second here with your next quote, but I think that understanding what other countries have done to help people in different cultures might be something that we could look for in our medical education.
Moving from that, I have a quote here from Pietri Nemi John Kasim and Fadalina Elias. For example, the Good Medical Practice, a code of conduct for doctors in Australia, issued by the Medical Board of Australia, contains provisions on culturally safe and sensitive practice, which state that good medical practice involves genuine efforts to understand the cultural needs and context of different patients to obtain good health outcomes, which includes having knowledge of, respect for, and sensitivity towards the cultural needs of the community that one serves, including those of Indigenous Australians, acknowledging the social, economic, cultural, and behavioral factors influencing health, both at individual and population levels, and understanding that one's own culture and beliefs influence one's interactions with the patients. In Clause 3.12 of this, which deals with end-of-life care, respect and support for the values and wishes of the patient and family members, it emphasizes that having different cultural practices related to death and dying are important for physicians to realize. Though the curriculum for medical students in the U.S. is already extremely rigorous, other countries, such as Australia, as said above, have put in place a cultural, spiritual education requirement in order to serve patients to the best of their ability, something that I feel would be highly important to implement in the US in order to better support those people and make them more comfortable in their end of life process? Because having the utmost comfortability and respect towards that person can lead to better health outcomes for that for those people. Next, moving on to our second question, can euthanasia be used to improve the relief of pain in the end of life care process? And is it ethical for physicians to take life instead of letting death naturally take its course, even as it would prevent suffering?
Yeah, so I think something that's important to understand here is the difference between killing and allowing to die, which I have a quote from Dan Brock's article. The nature of the difference between killing and allowing to die is morally important, if as many believe allowing to die can be morally justified in circumstances in which killing would not be. If there's no moral difference between the two, it is not morally important how we distinguish them. So understanding the difference between this is one thing that I think is very crucial to understand when we're talking about euthanasia. This is because if a patient is suffering and in pain, do physicians take the opportunity to help them, or do they just allow the patient to suffer? And this is something that we will touch on a little bit more after this, but I think it's crucial to understand the difference between killing and allowing someone to die morally.
Yes, that is an important distinction, especially when in many ways allowing the person to die naturally will cause them more pain and suffering in many cases of euthanasia. The issue with this is that the person's intent are not being heard, and therefore they are not being given the freedom to choose how they are able to live their lives. And as an American, the diminishing of these freedoms, I feel, is a infringement on our rights.
Yeah, to go off that, Dan Brock also talks about self-determination and allowing people to make decisions for themselves. And he also talks about treating patients for their pain and potentially hastening their lives or letting them live in agony in their last moments and dying anyway. We've talked about this in class before, the doctrine of the double effect. And I think that's also something that is pretty important to understand for the end of life care of, should we allow people to hasten their deaths and live their last few days peacefully, I guess, or should we just euthanize them and allow them to die peacefully without suffering at all?
To move on to our next question, I believe
if a patient has made an agreement under full cognition not to be given pain medication for religious or cultural reasons, but near the end are suffering, does a physician adhere to the original agreement, or does he help the patient in need as he has taken an oath to do so?
I have a quote that might provide further insight on this question posed here. From Francis Mirnakam again, in particular, while a ground given for attending to patients' preferences is that views on what constitutes a good death vary, many professionals have a particular view of what is a good death and hope to promote it for what they see as a patient's own good. Having such aims is not necessarily wrong, but it is worth bringing out clearly for the sake of full disclosure, and because conflict could arise between those aims and the patient's preferences. So even though the patient may be suffering, if the doctor intervened, the wishes of the cognizant patient have been broken, potentially removing the dignity from that patient. In many religions, the accepting of certain medications can be against their principles and could be considered the equivalent of a sin in those religions. So, as a physician, realizing this might allow them to make further decisions which could help to benefit or disbenefit the individual's freedom to choose whether or not they want to receive that medication, or if the physician is well versed in these cultural or religious practices, they can therefore provide alternative solutions that could help to further give dignity to those individuals in that end-of-life care process.
Yeah, I think it's important for the physician to understand their cultural background, but I think it's also important to accept the patient's wishes as they are in the current moment. Not many people think about what they're gonna feel like if they're not actually in pain. So I think the current situation of the patient is important to understand. And if they're in pain now, that they might not have thought about what they were feeling like when they weren't suffering or already in this end-of-life care process. They might have thought, I can do it without taking any extra medication or whatnot, but you never know. You never know.
You really don't. In that case, I will move on to the next question. In the case of a patient who has agreed not to receive euthanasia in a legal document, but later requested it after having the experience of extreme pain, which wishes should be honored by the physician?
So we have a quote here from Warren that I think will explain this a little bit. According to the philosopher Immanuel Kant, rationality, dignity, and autonomy are the three attributes that distinguish humans from animals. To be rational is to be capable of acting in accordance with moral principles. To have dignity is to always treat oneself and others as having intrinsic worth and never simply as a means to an end. To be autonomous, literally means self-regulating, is to recognize that we are free only to the extent that we act in accordance with moral principles, ones we have freely, voluntarily, and rationally chosen. Then by refusing to let people use euthanasia, you aren't allowing people to be rational beings. Also, by extending the death process, we are treating these beings as a means to an end.
Yeah, on going off of that, truly getting that experience of extreme pain, as you mentioned before, is very important for that individual's decision-making process when it comes to the aspect of euthanasia. Many people establish, oh, I'm never going to want to end my life before it naturally comes. However, after receiving a diagnosis and actually feeling an extreme illness and the pain and suffering that comes along with that, many people often rethink that decision making. However, if one signs a legal document stating that they do not want to be euthanized and then later have that experience, does the doctor listen to the more rational person at the beginning who signed this legal document stating this, or do they listen to the current wishes of the person who has had that experience of pain and would feel have the experience to then make that decision and say, yes, I need to end my life sooner. The pain is overwhelming and I would like to move forward and unburden my family with, say, medical bills and that grieving process. So moving forward, we have one last question that actually comes from inside of one of our sources from Jeff McCann. A persistent vegetative state involves the ceasing to exist of the person, but not the biological death of the organism. Can't be permissible to remove a persistently vegetative patient's organs for transplantation. This would involve the killing of a human organism, and the killing would be intentional in a familiar sense.
I think that there's two sides really to this coin here. One is the person who is in the persistent vegetative state, and the family side of this, and then also the person who would be receiving the organs. So you have to think about the familiar connection that the people would be going through with living with the person in the persistent vegetative state. What are they thinking, and are they banking on a medical miracle here, or is there a chance at life? I think that is one difficult decision that people are forced to make in the end of life care process, and I think using them as a means to end almost is a beneficial thing when you're helping someone who is in need, but I think there's definitely two different ways of looking at how that could turn out.
I agree. Obviously, the intent of the individual before they went into that vegetative state, say they signed a preliminary motion to die naturally beforehand, but you know, in that vegetative state, they obviously are brain dead, so they cannot make that decision whether to continue live or die. That is then pushed upon the family, which is a very large burden for any family to feel. But going off of that, I feel that using them as a means to an end only comes along if the family did this after the person in a rational state gave their intent that they did not want this to happen. If there has been no inclination by the person in that state, I would say that the family has the right and the ability to then say, okay, it is time to end the life early so that the organs can be harvested and used to save other lives, which is extremely hard decision to make, but one that's definitely beneficial for the community and arguably moral.
All right, to conclude end of life care, it is an important aspect of healthcare that needs to prioritize the patient's comfort and protect their self-determination. To better understand this, we looked at a couple of different situations that might arise when thinking about the end of life care. May that be through cultural, spiritual, or euthanasia. We discussed the idea of expanding the curriculum so that there's a better understanding of what the patient's cultural beliefs are and how that would affect their end-of-life decisions. Following that up with the idea of using euthanasia as a way of relieving a patient from pain and suffering and understanding that some patients may choose to die rather than suffer. Lastly, we explored the idea of the moral dilemma a physician faces when culturally someone has chosen not to receive medication that will help their pain, and what it would look like for the physician to go against their oath. Thanks for joining us.